Mueller House Meeting, Tuesday afternoon, 8th April 1975. Are there any questions anyone wants to ask? Any perplexities needing to be solved? Something which has not been clearly understood? Any mistakes I've made which you'd like to correct? Oh no, don't laugh, I can easily make mistakes. I think we have covered the major aspects of the reality of living the religious life fairly well during these 6 days that we have met together. There are aspects which are so profound that although hearing about them may make a deep impression upon the inner depths of the mind, which may perhaps even be a source of inspiration, there is much that escapes our conscious attention and our immediate understanding. We can now leave those for some future occasion. For this final meeting, let us just touch upon some of the simple aspects, the practical aspects of living the religious life. First and foremost, we must wake up to the fact that the pleasure drive in us takes us, or rather, let me put it this way, that it keeps us tied down to a state of worldliness. Now, it would be a mistake to think that to live the religious life means to drive out all pleasure in our life and be rather solemn, a bore and a nuisance to ourselves and to others. The human body is so constituted that pleasure in right proportion and of the right nature is indispensable for the health of the body and the sanity of the mind. This is why nature has evolved us in such a manner that this pleasure will reach us through the senses. And this pleasure, which is at the level of humanness, is pleasure which is particularly associated with our aesthetic sense. Not merely a case of the cultivated aesthetic sense through our socio-cultural training, the different arts, the intellectual aesthetic pleasures, the beauty of thought, the real pleasure of true conversation with our fellow human beings. Not just idle chatter, that is extremely important to bear in mind, but true conversation. Such pleasures and those which we derive from the beauty of nature and which continually make an impact on us are the pleasures which are most conducive to the health of the body and the sanity of the mind. But in enjoying these cultural and pleasures and the pleasures of nature, we must be careful not to get over attached to any one of them, not to become the slave of our desire to have them repeated again and again for the sake of the delightful sensations we experience. After all, when we consider the pleasures of music or of the dance, those two particularly as compared with the other cultural pursuits like poetry or sculpture or painting, in those two the element of delightful sensation can be felt to its extreme limits, and we get caught up in it, and we want it repeated over and over and over again. So we must be free of that. And certainly, where all the pleasures which degrade our humanness should be avoided altogether. What are the pleasures that degrade our humanness? Must be left to the individual to decide for himself. That is one's own responsibility. I am just suggesting certain general matters for consideration. The difficulty with the pursuit of pleasure, mistaking it for the pursuit of happiness, arises because when we experience our everyday physical life, our bodily life, we experience it in terms of sensations which are painful or pleasant or neutral. Now, when the body, through the body and the bodily senses, we experience sensations that are pleasurable, the psyche immediately reacts by saying, "Oh, I like that, that was nice, I want more of it." Now the psyche doesn't know when to stop. Like a little child who likes a particular kind of sweet and tends to overeat. That sweet. This is the difficulty. And the result is that attachment arises. And the attachment becomes so intense that it becomes a craving which binds us. The physical aspect is inevitable. A pleasurable sensation under such circumstances, a painful sensation under other circumstances. We have to have that pleasure-pain mechanism of the body, otherwise the body would perish. That is nature's safeguard to enable us to move through the world with safety. And it teaches us many other things too. But the psychological, the psychical counterpart is where the trouble begins. As I said, with the pleasurable sensation, I like it, I get attached to it, and craving grows up. You take the painful sensation which comes in life, and the psyche says, oh, I don't like that. It doesn't just say, ah, that's a painful sensation, be careful, be sensible. Don't jump into the fire. You may never jump again if you do that. You see, it doesn't stop there. It says, oh, I dislike this, I don't want it. And it wants to get rid of it, to destroy it, and so forth. The result is that we remain tied within the limited sphere of discriminative consciousness all through the day. I like, I don't like. And we are controlled by our psychical I like, I don't like. This is a very important point to bear in mind. The pure pleasure pain of physical living and physical experience must be there for the sake of the continuity of life in the body and the healthy life of the body. But the psychical aspect is the aspect where we have control and we have to exercise maturity. When I was a child, I spake as a child, as St. Paul said. And when one grows up, one puts away childish things. But if we look at the 4,000 million people in the world, there is very little evidence that they put away childish things and really become mature in mind. That means they never realize the fruition of the most important aspect of their psychophysical existence, the activity and the life of the mind. Obviously then, we have to be perfectly sensible and matter of fact on this whole question of pleasure and watch the pleasure drive. This pleasure drive has very subtle expressions too. If a man is constituted that way, he derives so much sheer sensational delight from deep intellectual pursuits, from a spiritual activity, that he takes to that the slave of his pleasure drive. This is not true religiousness. Because if for any reason, by any accident or whatever it is, he ceased to derive pleasure, his intellectual activity and his spiritual efforts would just vanish away into thin air. He doesn't derive pleasure anymore out of it. You see? So we have to be very careful. There is one final point in this connection which is of the utmost importance. The pleasure drive invariably and inevitably keeps us confined to self-centeredness. It is always self-oriented. When we don't think carefully, we will say, oh, but I am doing this in order to make somebody else happy. If you look into that, you will find that the person has identified himself with the other, and through the other's pleasure, vicariously, he derives pleasure, sheer sensational pleasure. So one has to be extremely careful and watch Mephistopheles playing his game and say, all right, Mephistopheles, I know you. Now I mentioned Mephistopheles. If you look at the Buddhist texts, you will find again and again through the discourses, either the Buddha himself or one of his great disciples turns around and says, "Oh yes, Mara, I know you." Mara being the Pali counterpart of Satan or Ahriman or the tempter or the devil or whatever you like. "I know you. Don't think for a moment you can deceive me." And so, let's put aside. Finished, just like that. So this pleasure drive is the most powerful drive in us, which keeps us self-centered, self-oriented. And that, of course, prevents the true religious life, the religious approach. Which means, remember, the true human approach. The irreligious approach is the subhuman approach. And the subhuman is not an animal. An animal is a good animal. Nature has made animals naturally good. They live their lives in all that they do in tune with the law of their being. It is we who don't. So when we descend and continue to live in the subhuman, at the subhuman level, we are the only ones on this planet who can be bestial in that nasty meaning of the word bestial. We are bad beasts, not bad animals. There's no such thing as a bad animal. All animals are good. This body by itself, which is an animal body, is the best animal body that nature produced. Its potentialities are so wonderful that no other animal compares with it. And it's the pleasure drive which is the most powerful force preventing the fruition of our humanity. This is something of which we should be extremely mindful all day and every day. And this drive is very subtle. And the major part of it, probably 99% of it, lies in the unconscious depths. It is below the conscious level of the mind, and therefore we get caught out. We are tripped up from behind, so to say. If we really understand that, we will really, truly appreciate how and why the great teachers were concerned with our real happiness and not with the expenditure of our life energy incontinently in pleasure. When one expends one's life energy in that way, in mere pleasure, then one is unchaste. This is the big meaning of unchastity. The chaste person, the clean, pure person, is the self-contained person who does not uselessly squander any energy. You see? This is one of the most important aspects in daily practice of the religious life. The next thing we must bear in mind is to be mindful, watchful of everything without taking sides. This is difficult. We take sides not only because of our subhuman nature, but we take sides even when we are educated, when we are trying to be, as we call it, moral, good, doing the right thing, and progressing in ourselves and so forth. we make a choice. This is good, I'll do it. This is bad, I must somehow get rid of it or be free of it. So we pay attention, our attentiveness is tainted with choice. Now, this is a very difficult point indeed. One will naturally ask, but what option is there in everyday life? You have to do this or do that. You see this is good and you do it. And you see that is bad and you fight against it. Now, it is true that I see this is good, I see that is bad. But do I see wholly, truly? That is another matter. If you want a proof of this, just look at the inveterate habit people have when things go wrong of always blaming the other person, of always putting the blame upon the situation, the government, the authorities, the laws. I am all right, I am a good fellow, I am right. I always know what is right, I am so marvelous. 10 years later, I say, well, you know, I didn't see the situation quite clearly, but now I know all about it. 20 years later, I say the same thing. And 40 years later, I grow up to some sort of maturity and say, what I know, what I really know, is that I do not know. When we see that, when we say that I see this is good and I see that is bad and I take sides, I see only from a limited point of view. I never see the thing in its wholeness. I never see the thing in its wholeness because subconsciously, in the depths, are my ready-made criteria, my judgments. This, of course, is the truth. This, of course, is not true. This, of course, is right and good. And that, of course, is not right and good. But that, of course-ness has no warrant in the context of the total reality. Supposing suddenly you could become like God and be omniscient and see the whole reality, then what are you going to say? See, this is one of our problems. Therefore, we must be sufficiently alert to note how we exercise choice. To be aware choicelessly, without taking any sides whatever, means to be aware in terms of a transcendent depth, not at a mere dualistic, ambivalent level. This is very, very important. We are caught up in ambivalence every day of our lives. You can watch this rise up in all sorts of situations, big and important ones, little and petty ones throughout the day. Our reaction will usually be in terms of ambivalence, the dualistic either or situation. Rarely will it be in terms of wholeness, because you have seen both sides of the question. Or there may be 3 or 4 or 20 sides to the question. The best, the greatest, the finest type of judge in a court of law, is a person who dispassionately looks at everything that is presented. Now you see, we have to try and develop that capacity to be able to look at everything that touches us personally as well as what touches those around us, like this judge in the court who looks at all the evidence, and he must be capable of collecting and seeing all the evidence. It's a tremendous task, but it's a very important task. There comes the time in one's life when suddenly it becomes easy. It becomes easy because through our life experience, something or other may happen which suddenly goes home with such intensity that all self-orientedness vanishes like that. And that means that we have ceased to grasp particular things for ourselves, to be tied to them, to hold on to them. Whatsoever is our actual responsibility as given to us by life, we must fulfill as trustees. We are trustees for it. That's all. This very body is not mine. It is part and parcel of the universal body. This mind of which we commonly say is my mind is not my mind. It's part of the universal reality. What is there which is mine? What is there that I can hold and say forever and ever this is me or I? I can't. Only the one total reality can say that. It is contained within it all. The particular pattern dissolves, and with it all the characteristics, all the achievements, all the qualities, they all dissolve away. You see, death, the inseparable companion of whatsoever is manifested as life. And if one is awake to this, then the heart becomes filled with understanding and compassion. And the mind becomes so clear that you see the truth of the matter in its wholeness, not from a particular selfish point of view. And then your action will be the rightest possible action under the circumstance. This is, of course, a very difficult matter, but there it is. That is part, an important part, of religious living. Another, in association with this, meet and take everything that is put in your own path by transcendence. Meet it and take it. Respond to it fully, serve it fully, and above all, learn from the whole experience and let go the shape of the experience. The material of the experience must not be held on to, either in terms of a physical result or in terms of a thought or an idea or what we call a guiding principle. Even a guiding principle. Because my guiding principle today is limited by my own deficiencies as far as perception into the whole reality is concerned. If I hold on to this guiding principle just exactly as it is, I shall never grow. I shall never see more deeply and more truly. I shall be confined. Therefore, let it go. Life is super generous. It will pour itself into you. Don't hold on to anything. Let it go. And life will pour into you all the time that which will bring about the fulfillment and the glory of life in its wholeness, of transcendence, not of the particular person. Life pours into the particular person what is most appropriate to the pattern of that particular person. And it is that person's personal responsibility to see life intends this of me. Take for instance a simple case. I have actually met such people in my lifetime, so perhaps I can speak from actual experience. A person comes along, filled with the passion to become a millionaire. Why does he want to become a millionaire? Because if I am a millionaire, I can do this and that and the other for the good of humanity. This is the common excuse. When I look at these people, I see that they have no capacity really to use the power of money rightly. They haven't even the ghost of a conception of what is the true meaning of the good of humanity. They think in entirely limited terms, in terms which will enhance the pleasures which people can enjoy, in terms which will organize for the satisfaction of all greeds and stupid, passionate, foolish pursuits. This is what they mean by doing such and such good. When you do it, there are instances where somebody succeeds in doing that. And then what is the final result? The persons for whom they were supposed to be doing so much good have been distorted in life, twisted, and there is misery and suffering. So don't think in those terms. It's a terrible conceit on my part if I were to say, oh, if only I had this, that and the other at my command, I could do this, that and the other wonderful good. Not at all. Remember again what Jesus said. When the person came up and said, good master, and he answered back saying, why callest thou me good? There is only one that is good, and that is God. The infinite, the unknown. Jesus was the sinless one, and he would not accept the epithet of good. There is wisdom. So, meet everything that transcendence puts in your path. You can take that on faith, that whatever comes into your daily life is put there by this total reality for you. This web of fate, as I called it some time back, a few days back, you remember? If you can meet it that way and be awake to it that way, then your own web of destiny will come to fruition. To real fruition. Someday you can wake up to the fact that it is fruition, although it may seem on the surface to be full of failure, pain, disillusionment, sorrow. Some people's lives are like that. And they have really a very heavy cross to carry, a very heavy burden, a deep sorrow. But if they wake up to the fact that it is this way that transcendence is manifesting its transcendence through me, then there is an inner peace and an inner happiness with which nothing that this world can give you compares. We know of Jesus as a man of sorrows. Buddhism presents the Buddha as the one who had realized nirvana here now. And how do we translate nirvana? Oh, as an inconceivable happiness. And our feeling in relation to that word is something wonderfully pleasurable. Don't forget those marvelous words in the Book of the Golden Precepts. The path of a Buddha is filled with unutterable woe. When one is the perfected Holy One, one is totally sensitive to everything around him. And what is there around us in the lives of mortals particularly? Frustration, conflict, confusion, fear, terrible sorrow, which eats away the heart of man. That is there in preponderant measure in human life. But if one is free from the pleasure drive oneself, if one is free of taking sides with the pleasant against the unpleasant, if one is truly mindful and watchful, if one truly accepts and meets with the whole of one's being, gives the whole of one's being to whatsoever transcendence puts in your path, then you are a man, truly a man. And it is to such people that India and also Chinese civilization gave the title of hero. He is the hero, not the conqueror, not the destroyer, not the one who dominates and oppresses others or all mankind, but the one who met life in this way. He is the hero. It's wonderful. You know how in the case of the Buddha, he is also called leader of the caravan, the tamer of men. And you can't tame an animal unless you have infinite compassion, infinite love and patience. You who have trained horses or dogs or any such animals, you know that from your own experience, don't you? That is the case. Then, when body and mind are free of all grasping, the spirit is unburdened. The spirit within is quite unburdened. And then you know the bliss of freedom. And this unburdened state of the spirit is the meaning of poverty. Not being deprived of the means of existence. That is not the poverty which is talked of in all the scriptures. To be free of the burden of possessions and so forth. But when the spirit itself is unburdened of all the accumulated ideas and beliefs and conceptions which have practically no relationship to reality, to truth, then the spirit has at last realized the blessedness of poverty. Blessed are the poor in spirit. See the meaning of it. And as you see these meanings and realize these conditions, this is the living of the religious life. This is the coming to fruition of our humanity. In simple terms, in simple forms, which all of us can understand. Simple, but difficult to do. All the loveliest things in music, for instance, or in any of the great arts, are the simplest things. If you can play a slow movement of Mozart with perfection, you are one of the world's supreme pianists. It's so simple. Its simplicity is deceptive. It requires perfection to play it. It's like that. Truth, reality, is utterly simple at its heart. But it is most extraordinarily complex in its actual manifestation. We, being ignorant, fail to see the complex living structure of reality. Take the human body alone. What a wonderfully complex structure it is. But all the principles that govern its healthy life are utterly simple. When this complex structure is prevented from living simply by our pursuit of pleasure or whatever it is, our foolishness, then this complex structure becomes complicated. And complication is illness. You know, it's a phrase that doctors use always. The operation was highly successful, but 3 days later complications set in and the patient died. See, complication. The lack of clarity. When the mind gets complicated, it is a confused mind. It's tied up in knots. It has no vision. The man of vision is the man whose mind sees with perfect clarity. And he sees everything quite simply. And this is a case where a pair of religious eyes, mentally, are looking at it. And these are the things we have to bear in mind. And when body and mind are free, the spirit is unburdened, then there is the bliss of freedom. Then we understand what nirvana really means. Its first meaning, its literal meaning, is the extinction, the blowing out. Nirvana is the blowing out. And of course people say, what? Annihilation? Nirvana is annihilation? But they don't wait for the whole meaning. It is the blowing out, the extinction of greed, hate, delusion, fear, stupidity, and all the other defilements. When these are extinguished, what we commonly call my mind is utterly empty and pure. And the faculty of intelligence has come to full flower and taken its proper place in the mental life of the person. The faculty of intelligence, the power to see the truth of things as they are, unspoiled by all the heap of fixed ideas and beliefs and so on. So nirvana means the blowing out, the extinction of all the defilements of the mind. My little simile: remove the dirt in the room and the room is clean. Be free of all the petty little concepts and everything, and the mind at last is pure intelligence functioning freely. That is how it is. Then man is man. So, let us bear these few simple things in mind. Day after day, as we live our life. The non-grasping is the most difficult thing, because we fear. We hold on to our possessions, to our money, and to our family, and this, that, and the other. We fear loss. But watch that fear and don't grasp, and you will in all likelihood find something richer and more wonderful will take its place. You know how it is, if you don't throw away all the rotten old furniture which clutters up your house, there is no room for good furniture to be put into it. It's a little bit like that, only a little bit, because you see the assumption there is that you can afford to buy the good new furniture or that it will be presented to you. All similes have their drawbacks, of course. Now look, let us spend just a few moments in meditation. Here we have met together these days. Do we know each other? Can we and do we really look at each other? And when we look at each other, what do we see? Do we see the person, the whole living person, exactly as he or she is? Or do our conditioned reactions prevent us seeing the reality of that person? Because the truth of that person is that he or she is embodied transcendence, hidden maybe, covered over, ill at ease sometimes, but the living being is transcendence embodied. You are looking at the handiwork of God Himself when you look at a person. That is the actual fact, the transcendent fact. But what is it that happens when I look? My reactions, little annoyances, little conceptions, little desires, passions, they're all at play, aren't they? So under those circumstances, how can there be loving kindness? How can there be human unity? Because right within myself I am already a disunity. So now, let us spend just a few moments bearing that in mind, and letting our hearts and minds quietly, in the silence, open out towards each other and realize that we are a united group here. Realize that the person whom we regard as the other person is only another version of myself, just as I am another version of that person. The strands of complete relationship are invisible still. But they can become manifest if we are free from possessiveness with respect to the other person. If we are free from demanding anything from the other, from expecting, all these are selfish energies which turn back upon oneself and spoil the beauty of the true living process. So realize this actual unity, not merely as a thought, but as a deep feeling. That is as far as we in our imperfect state can go. But if we go that far, then transcendence is a little bit freer to flow through us and effect the necessary purification. And then there is compassion in the true sense. There is wisdom. There is inward peace. And the turmoil, the external turmoil of the mind and the heart is completely at rest. And then we can realize in consciousness, in the deeps of consciousness, that we are all members of the one human family, the family of God. God the Father becomes a reality because we are truly brethren. And for a few moments, let the mind and heart feel the blessing of transcendence upon this house, upon this valley, upon those who live and work in it. And may it always become increasingly possible for all of them to live and work in harmony.